This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Welcome back to Saturday Magazine with Sonia and Macca. And we're going to have a guest very shortly, a Dr. Anthony Bendall. Now, that was the Kings of Convenience again, and that was a song of theirs, Summer on the West Hill. And they're a Norwegian band.
Well, it's a bit of a Norwegian theme happening, Dale.
Yeah, it's the weather.
Must be.
Not cold enough.
Must be. Now, on the line, we have Dr. Anthony Bendall, who is co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby and an anti-discrimination commissioner. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Now, tell us first about, sorry if I've got it right, Anti-Discrimination Commissioner?
No, I'm actually the Deputy Privacy Commissioner.
Deputy Privacy Commissioner, okay.
That's right.
So, how does this, how do you see, you obviously have to police ensuring that people's privacy is protected and also that their information.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult is that in an environment which we have, you know, that obviously has developed with much more of the internet? How much more difficult does that become?
Yes, I guess it becomes more and more difficult all the time with technology improving. And I guess really all we can do is try to keep up with the technology, and basically our jurisdiction is over the Victorian government, so it's trying to keep up with the types of technology that is used by the Victorian government and how they handle people's personal information. So, and we don't have a huge number of staff either, so it is quite a difficult task. But we basically do it by consulting with the government as much as we can and basically reminding them of the obligations they have under the privacy legislation. So while the technology has made it more difficult to do the job, basically the rules have stayed the same, really, so that despite the technology making it easier to do things, the rules about what you can do and how you should do it have stayed the same. Basically, the golden rule is to tell people how you're going to handle their information when you collect it, and then there's no surprises, basically. So, yeah.
Okay. And, Anthony, what would you say is the biggest threat to people's privacy these days? I mean, I would probably think things like Facebook.
Internet, yes.
And internet. Is that the biggest threat? Because people, I don't know, perhaps they tend to trust that medium more and surrender more information.
Businesses or employers can look at it.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's often talk about the fact that young people don't value their privacy at all because they use things like Facebook and YouTube so much. I think that's wrong. I think a lot of young people actually don't realise that they're communicating with the world when they're on that that medium. They actually do see it almost in the way that young people used to see their private diary and think that it's just being communicated to their friends, basically.
You never show your diary. Well, I never did when I was growing up. No
That's
way.
Right. So part of it, I think, is trying to raise the understanding of people who are using those media of the risks. You can actually have privacy settings and you can protect yourself, but I don't think there's enough effort going into to educating people
about that.
Maybe
they need
a
warning, like on a packet of cigarettes.
Yeah, that's right. I actually don't think that there's been a huge cultural change amongst people and that they don't value their privacy. I mean, privacy is a bit of a strange thing in that you don't really think about it until it's under threat, in a sense. So that I think, the work we've done with young people, and we've just set up a youth advisory group to try and do that a bit better. Basically, I don't think it's true that they don't value their privacy. When you make them think about it, they actually do. It's just that they often don't think about it. So, and young people just naturally are more likely to take risks and do silly things than those of us who are a bit older. So, yeah.
I know sometimes some of the information that you see people putting up there or people, you know, chatting about, they obviously don't. The concept, they perhaps don't realise what they're doing.
Mm.
So when you've just started this initiative, how what sort of reaction have people given? Are they really surprised?
Well, I guess the some of the young people that we've been dealing with were a little more savvy, I guess, to begin with than some others. But in their communications with their peers, I guess, yeah, that there is some degree of surprise, I think, as to how easy it is for your information to be put at risk online. And so I think we're going to try and work with schools and other places to raise awareness of that. I mean, it's not just young people either. there's research that the biggest increase in user group for Facebook is actually older people now, you know, the kind of retired people who are using it to keep up with, you know, their children and grandchildren who don't live in the same city that they live in and those sorts of things. So while they're probably not quite as likely to take risks, they're also not as tech savvy as younger people. So there's another age group that is at risk as well. So, yeah.
Mm. I mean, it's pretty... It is... the whole concept of privacy, I mean, we all obviously hold that very, very dear, but it must be difficult for you to obviously the government, you know, have a lot of information on people and to ensure that it's not just kept private from outside the government, but that it's not shared inappropriately within the government. Is that a big challenge?
Yeah, it is a fairly big challenge. And in fact, I guess that's the biggest risk within the government, basically, that it'll just be shared across all the departments and, you know, it'll be used for purposes other than for what it was collected for. So, yes, I mean, there's a degree of that's allowed by the legislation where it's a related secondary purpose to the purpose which it was collected for, and people would reasonably expect it to happen. So again, the collection becomes important, so that if when your information is being collected by one government department, if they're up front and say that they usually share it with another department, well then you've been put on notice and there's no surprises. But the other department that's collecting the information from them under the legislation, the collection has to be necessary for one of their functions, so they can't just get it because it'd be nice to have. It actually has to be a necessary collection for their functions, not for the functions of the organisation that collected it initially.
The bureaucracy that seems to be amounting from that. There was the person who tried to blow up that Detroit bound plane.
Yes.
He was on Facebook, but it seemed to take, obviously, some hold-ups before that information was of any use.
Well, that's right, and it seems that seemed quite extraordinary to us in a sense, in that for those sorts of matters where there's clearly a serious threat to public safety, the legislation allows information to be shared, and they seem to have the information. It just seemed to be they were quite incompetent at sharing it properly.
How do you do it, and where do you put it? And
that's right. Yeah.
Mm. So, I mean, let's just paint a scenario, Anthony, that I provide some information, perhaps to State Revenue Office.
Mm-hmm.
They then share that with, I don't know, Department of Human Services or something, but it's not what you would normally classify as necessary for human services. What sort of penalties or sanctions apply where a government department or an instrumentality does that?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, the way the Office of the Privacy Commissioner works is that somebody can make a complaint where they think their privacy has been interfered with. The office doesn't have a determination power, so we can't say that there has definitely been a breach of the Act. But what happens is we conciliate between the complainant and the department and try to seek some kind of resolution. Often, in a serious matter, that will involve the payment of some kind of compensation. Where conciliation isn't possible, either due to the pre-existing relationship between the two parties, or it just doesn't they just won't come to the party during the conciliation, that it just isn't appropriate, the complainant can require the Privacy Commissioner to refer the matter to the Civil and Administrative Tribunal.
Okay.
And then they can make orders of a range of things, including changing practices, and also they can order damages up to $100,000. So there can be a reasonably significant financial cost to organisations for serious breaches. So, yeah.
Now, do you think the... obviously, since September 11 and other incidents, do you think the environment is more conducive to respecting people's privacy, or do you think that governments of all colours tend to want information on people so they can make these assessments? How does it play out?
I think that's right. I think that since September 11th, that the environment has changed quite markedly towards not respecting privacy as much. But I guess part of what our office does is try to argue to government and more broadly to the community that in fact you can have to put it as a dichotomy between safety or security and privacy isn't quite the way to go, because privacy will always lose out then, basically, because obviously everybody wants to be safe. But in fact, we argue you can do both, and in fact, I guess the incident we were talking about just then shows that having a huge amount of information can actually sometimes be counterproductive, because if you don't use it, you know, if there's too much and you can't actually sift through it and decipher what it means, then in fact you let people who actually are dangerous slip through. So that some part of our discussion with government and others is certainly we have no beef about some collection of information for security purposes, but that should be done in a much more intelligent way, and really only the information is necessary. And in fact, that's probably a better way to do it than just collecting massive amounts of information about everyone, that in fact focusing on people that for all sorts of reasons actually do present a danger to the society is a better way to go than just blindly collecting, and monitoring absolutely everybody, because that just will mean that there's so much information that it's difficult to know what to do with it.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Now, with your other hat,
mm-hmm.
Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, it's been an interesting year, I suppose, some achievements and some disappointments.
Yeah, that's right.
What would you care in terms of the achievement for the year? What would you like to hang your hat on for the community?
Well, I guess part of it was bedding down the huge changes to federal law. There were some hiccups with that as well, naturally enough. There were some negative impacts for Centrelink recipients in that, but by and large, that was an enormous achievement. 85 pieces of legislation being changed to basically make same-sex relationships equivalent to heterosexual de facto relationships, and I think that it should be stressed what an extraordinary achievement that really was, that it's, to a large extent, achieved almost everything that the community's been working for decades in the federal sphere. So that was something, I think, to celebrate, despite the unfortunate fact that it wasn't done in a perfect way. And we would have preferred to have seen there be a grandfathering clause or something in there to protect...
Yeah, they do for other...
Centrelink recipients. Mm. But... having said that, I don't think that even though we were very disappointed and quite angry at the way that was handled, I don't think that nullifies the extraordinary achievement that the rest of the reforms represent. So I think that's certainly something to celebrate.
Now, in terms of disappointment, would you categorise that the same, that there wasn't the grandfathering? And
yeah, certainly that's one of them. I think we were fairly disappointed with the way the inquiry into exemptions and exceptions in the Victorian Equal Opportunity Act was handled by the government as well. That was sent off to... Well, initially, there was an inquiry in the Department of Justice about those exemptions and exceptions. They basically are exemptions to the blanket rule that you shouldn't discriminate, which are given to a range of different organisations. There are private clubs who can be one gender. What we focused on, and I guess what most of the media attention was focused on, was the exemption for religious bodies to discriminate, particularly in employment, where basically religious schools use that to discriminate in their employment practices of teachers. So basically that was inquired into by the Department of Justice. Then that report wasn't released. It was sent off by the government to the Scrutiny of Acts and Regulations Committee at the Victorian Parliament. The lobby made a submission, and I appeared and gave evidence into that inquiry. But before the inquiry reported, the Attorney-General preempted that by announcing that there would be some changes, but that the exemptions wouldn't be removed. So we were pretty disappointed with that decision, and in particular in the way it was done, in that the committee didn't even get to report before the government decided what they were going to do. So that certainly was one of the major disappointments of the year. So
I mean, the thing is, if I, if Sonia and I, let's just say we started a religion, we got registered as a religion, and we're employing people, and we said we weren't going to employ heterosexuals. There would be
blood on the streets.
There'd be blood on the streets.
Yes, I mean that's right, and in a sense it's a bit more insidious than that as well. Often the religious bodies don't have a blanket discrimination. They're allowed to do that, but often they don't. It'll often be used selectively when they've fallen out with the person, with the employee, over something else, and they'll find out something about them which they say offends their religious sensibilities, and they'll use that to get rid of the person.
There was that female teacher who was pregnant living with her partner,
right.
But they weren't married.
And
I suppose if the Catholic Church wanted to dismiss all the homosexuals, there'd be a lot of closed churches.
Yeah, that's true, yes.
Now, just quickly, Anthony, same-sex marriage and adoption.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Is it going to be necessary in a way? Oh, this is my opinion, I suppose. It's a question as a statement, but should we, in terms of fighting for these rights, is the word marriage, is that the big hang-up that stops a lot of people, obviously not the people that support it, but those that are sort of in two minds about it? And is it the marriage word that really is stopping this, or is it something deeper?
I think that's part of it. I think that the use of the word marriage and to an extent a kind of misunderstanding, I think, of the role that marriage plays in the civil sphere is a problem amongst some politicians and some other people in the community. Basically, the lobby's position is that there should be equality and it should be called marriage, I guess, in order for the symbolic role of marriage that it plays in the community to extend to the whole community, and the symbolic role that would play in indicating that discriminating against people in same-sex relationships isn't on, nothing else will actually quite do that to the same extent. But in terms of getting practical rights and benefits, it almost doesn't matter what you call it, provided the rights and benefits are the same.
It's an equal rights issue.
That's right, yeah. And to an extent, that's almost largely happened, except that the rights that heterosexual de factos have are now almost equivalent for same-sex relationships, except that there's a time period, so you can't just rock into a registry office and, you know, a week after you've met each other and have those rights by choice. You have to wait until you've been living together for a certain period. So
you've
got to
have your
fairness lies.
Got to have your pee plates on.
That's right. Yeah.
And adoption as well. I mean, that. Whilst probably in terms of its its recognition in the community is probably a bit lesser, but actually my take is I think that's actually going to be harder. It's this whole thing about children and those issues that people have a lot of misconceptions. Yeah. Am I wrong there?
Well, some jurisdictions have already legislated to make adoption equal for same-sex couples and heterosexual de factos, basically. I think Tasmania and South Australia and a number of other states have done so. Victoria looked at it, and then Victoria referred it off to a working group under the Committee of Attorneys General, the COAG, the SCAG, the Standing Committee of Attorneys General.
Great term, that, isn't it?
But basically, they're still looking at that. I mean, to an extent, it's, again, a symbolic move, because in terms of adoption of unknown children, there are very few children available in Australia. And I think almost all the countries that Australia has treaties with that have children available for adoption by Australians won't adopt to same-sex couples. So to an extent, it won't make much difference in that sphere for adoption of a child you don't know. Where it's important, of course, is where there's an existing child and an existing relationship. So, for instance, one of the partners in the relationship has a child from a previous heterosexual relationship, or a child's produced by IVF or a surrogate or one of those scenarios. And for the rights of that child to have both partners who they see as their parents have a legal basis for the role in their lives, then adoption is probably the best way for that to happen. And so that's the real importance of the adoption laws being changed, largely because the adoption of unknown children is going to be very difficult unless those countries that have the children change their attitudes towards same-sex couples anyway. But it's that scenario where what you're really doing is affirming the rights of a child in the existing family relationship, where it's important. So,
Now, in a jurisdiction overseas, is there someone that's doing same-sex unions, same-sex marriage, same civil unions? Is there a model that you admire and you think this is a good template for Australia?
I think New Zealand is doing a reasonable job. They extended civil unions to both same-sex couples and heterosexual couples, so that it was just another option for heterosexuals, basically. The United Kingdom introduced civil unions, but they limited it only to same-sex couples, and there are complaints coming from some heterosexual couples in the UK who, for all sorts of reasons, and quite well-founded reasons, don't like the idea of marriage because of the historical aspects of how women were treated in marriage, basically, who want to have a civil union, but they can't because it's only for same-sex couples. So I think that's a bit unfortunate in a sense. I think if it's introduced, there's no reason why heterosexuals shouldn't be allowed to do it as well. The very surprising country, really, was Spain, who just made marriage, the laws apply to same-sex couples, and given how Catholic Spain is, that was a surprise at the time. And really, that's worked extraordinarily well. You know, the sky didn't fall in. There's been, you know, several thousand, I think, marriages in Spain in the years since, and you know, people just got over it, basically, and it's the best example of, there's a huge ruckus about it at the time, but once it happens, no one really notices except the people who want to get married, so.
Yeah, I mean, Spain surprised me, but also I'd have to say the UK that, okay, Spain is predominantly a Catholic country, the UK Protestant and Church of England, but in terms of doing something like this, you know, the civil unions for same-sex couples, that a country, you know, like the UK, which in many ways is progressive, but in others it's not in the class system, I found that quite interesting that, that they could do it, and yet Australia, which we predominantly have one of the lowest rates of, in the Western world, of people, you know, saying that they're Christians or religious. But it's sort of a... What do you see politically? What needs to happen for movement on this, Anthony? What do you think it's going to take?
Well, I think partly it is that the politicians, I think, are behind the rate of change in the community on this. I mean, there's been a number of surveys that have shown up to 60% of Australians are actually in favour of gay marriage. So I think we basically just need to keep reminding the politicians of that and basically keep arguing the argument around equality and justice, and hopefully eventually that that will work. I mean, some people are concerned about how conservative the Prime Minister is. I'm in kind of two minds about that. I think that partly it is that they set their platform before the last election, and he's been pretty keen on not changing those things in this term at least. And I'd like to think that even if he is conservative, he's a reasonably intelligent person, and you can still make arguments to him that eventually will make some ground basically with him. So to make the argument that it really doesn't change the nature of marriage, particularly if you don't call it marriage, but that in fact, you know, in other jurisdictions the sky hasn't fallen and it hasn't made any difference at all to heterosexual marriage, and that there's no reason not to do it, basically.
I guess it comes down to votes, and he has been openly talked about his religious beliefs, and this is a secular society, I thought.
Yep.
And what is going on?
Yeah
and but I mean, often, you know, the situation we have is that, you know, if this was an issue specifically around heterosexuality, it would be dealt with. And I think it's important to remind the politicians, and I make this point quite a bit, that the politicians and the political parties that have supported reform in every area of same-sex relationships, there has not been a negative electoral consequence.
Yes.
And what I believe is that now, you know, that it's incumbent on us as a community to say to our politicians, and you know, we have a state election and a federal election next year, to say to them, this issue is important enough for me to consider how I vote. And unfortunately, not enough people will do that.
No, I think that's right. And
only those that actually that want, I suppose, to, you know, to have their relationship recognised in that way.
Yeah, I guess part of the role that the lobby's going to play in this next year, hopefully, is to try and encourage the community, and also to talk to politicians around those things, certainly about marriage. The federal issues that we also want to lobby around is federal anti-discrimination legislation on sexual orientation and gender identity basis, and the Human Rights Charter. So those three things, I think, will be the things that we when we're meeting with politicians leading up to the election, that we'll be raising. For the state election, I think the issues are the ones we've talked about, the Equal Opportunity Act changes and adoption. So, because by and large, most other areas of law in Victoria have actually been successfully changed. So,
but that Human Rights Charter, I mean, I don't understand why that hasn't been pushed forward first. It should really be. Then everything would surely follow underneath
that
umbrella.
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, basically, it's the... We would see the anti-discrimination legislation at a federal level, basically fulfilling what the promises you make in the Human Rights Charter, and that you then make marriage equal because you've
because you've got a human rights charter.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I think Rob Hulls has been cloned. I think that's what's happened. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. I think you really appreciate it. Now, as we get closer to the Victorian and federal elections on Saturday Magazine, we are hoping to have some good, strong debates in the studio here with candidates, and we'll certainly invite you along to perhaps you can keep the different parties separate. stop them coming to blows. But
happy to do that.
Thank you very, very much for your work for the lobby, and interested to hear about the Privacy Commission. Now, what's the website for the Privacy Commission?
It's www.privacy.vic.gov.au.
Cool. Okay. Well, let's hope that if people have a concern there, they can have a look there and seek some remedy or seek some advice.
Okay, that's fine. And, of course, the lobby's one is vglrl.org.au. So cool. If people want to get in contact with the lobby, they can look at that too.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you very much, and Happy
Thanks
New Year.
Thanks very much.
Yep, same to you.
Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there we go. That was
interesting.
Dr. Anthony Good. Bendall, who, yes, I kept saying he was something else, but he's Deputy Privacy Commissioner. You may not think that's important, you know, what they do, but it actually really is, because it's about you and it's about your information and it's about it being used appropriately. So, you know, have a look at that.
And just that awareness too. That
absolutely.
Maybe they do need a warning on it, like a cigarette packet. I mean, that seems a bit naff, but...
Yeah. Now, look, I'm not going to read it out, but we've had a couple of SMSs.
Oh, good.
About what Mikey stands for, and some of them quite disparaging.
Oh, dear.
I'm not going to read them out.
Okay. But roughly, bit of venting, is it? Or?
Oh, you know. One of the letters, of course, is K for Koski.
Oh, so, right. We'll leave it there.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Mm. But we actually have Community Roundup, don't we?
We do. It's excellent. Yeah.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.